You're listening to Mammal Watching with Charles Foley and John Hall. You can find other episodes at mammalwatching.com/podcast.
Welcome to the Mammal Watching podcast with me, John Hall, in New York.
And me, Charles Foley, in Minnesota. Happy New Year, John.
Happy New Year, Charles.
How has your New Year been for you?
My New Year's not been great, actually. I got back from a long trip to Australia and Japan and got sick within 3 hours of landing in New York, and that's last week gone. Yeah, so I don't know where I caught that, but it must have been on the plane, but it was bloody rough. But Christmas and New Year were great. How about you?
Yeah, Christmas and New Year, very good. I was able to get up to northern Minnesota for a little while, and even though we had virtually no snow, which was extremely unusual. But anyway, I was able to find a few interesting mammal species, including American martins, which are actually really easy to find at the moment. And I also saw an ermine, or the form of the short-tailed weasel.
Yeah.
Very nice to see. And also lots of snowshoe hares. And also in the Saxon Bog, I saw four great-great owls on one morning. But I should point out that all of these species are actually readily seen over here at the moment. So if anyone is interested in finding them, you should make your way up here.
Wow. Where were the ermine? Were they at Saxim?
Yeah, they were Saxim. All of these animals were at Saxim, and they put out a deer carcass, and the ermine comes round, and I waited for half an hour, 45 minutes, and then it came up to the carcass. So it's great sighting.
Oh, cool. Lucky you.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And you've been in Australia, seeing some Australian mammals, I gather.
Yeah, no, I went over, my son Patrick's has moved over there now. So we went over there for Christmas and dropped him off. And although it was really Christmas with friends, I did go mammal watching a little bit, and I've forgotten how wonderful the Australian bush is. The dawn chorus. We went camping the first night we got there in the highlands of Victoria, and the bird song in the morning was mind-blowing. There is really nowhere like it. And the other thing that struck me was how I wish when I lived there, I'd had a thermal scope, because it is such, I mean, they're a game changer, as you know, in so many places, but in Australia, I think more than anywhere, it's remarkable the stuff you can see with a thermal scope that I'd never seen before. So I probably spent 1,500 hours spotlighting Australia, and I'd never seen a feather-tailed glider properly. The only pygmy possums I'd ever seen were coming out of researchers' traps or in nest boxes. But the first evening, in a couple of hours spotlighting with a thermal scope, we got multiple feather-tailed gliders, several pygmy possums, and a bunch of other stuff. It's just extraordinary how much more you can see with thermal scopes there in particular. So, yeah, another reason to love them.
Amazing pieces of kit. And I noticed actually that the price of thermals at Pulsar has dropped significantly in the last few months. So I think they've dropped by about $500 for most models. So anyway, should anyone be looking for a late Christmas present, there you go.
Or wants to buy me one. Yeah.
Now, John, avid listeners to the podcast might remember that a number of episodes back, we had a little test where we played an animal sound to see if people could figure out what it was. And today we have another such test where we are going to play an animal sound. And if you think you know what it is, you can go to the mammalwatching.com website and find a post for this podcast and put your answer in the comments section, or otherwise just reach out to John or I directly. And I must say, this one is really difficult, because to my mind, it doesn't sound anything like the noise one might expect this species to make. So here is the sound, and I will play it twice. So there you have it. John, I think because this one is so difficult, perhaps we should give people a few clues.
I would not have a clue myself, had I heard that, apart from Velociraptor. And I don't even know It's extraordinary that this animal does sound like that. So yes, I think some clues would be fair.
Well, it's a large mammal found in Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
And it's also rare, isn't it?
Very rare.
Very,
very, very rare. Yeah.
Vanishingly rare.
Vanishingly rare. Probably because it sounds like that and nothing wants to mate with it.
In fact, I suspect this was the first time that these sounds have ever been recorded for this species.
Yeah,
so as I said, if you know the answer, drop us a line and let us know, and we will reveal all at the beginning of the next podcast. So our guest today is Dr. Patricia Wright. Patricia is a professor of anthropology at Stony Brook University, and she is the founder and executive director of the Institute for the Conservation of Tropical Environments at Stony Brook, as well as of the Centre Valbio in Madagascar. She is one of the world's foremost experts on lemurs and is best known for her nearly 30-year study of social and family interactions of wild lemurs in Ranomafana National Park in Madagascar. She has worked extensively on conservation, and in the late 1980s, she spearheaded the project that led to the establishment of Ranomafana National Park, which is one of the flagship national parks in Madagascar. She has received numerous honours for her conservation work, including the MacArthur Fellowship in 1989, the prestigious National Medal of Honour of Madagascar in 2012, and she was the winner of the Indianapolis Prize in 2014, which is considered the Nobel Prize for the Environment. Patricia, thank you so much for agreeing to be on the programme. It's wonderful to have you here.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Thanks, Patricia. I can't wait to hear your stories and listen to you.
So perhaps you could start off by telling us where you grew up and how you became interested in wildlife.
I grew up in a small town in western New York State. I think the town was a population of about 400 people. So I lived outside very often, being in the countryside, and learned to love animals from a very young age. I would say at two, I was already, you know, following animals and doing the best I could to learn about them.
And so your interest started about two, but then it focused later on primates. How did you become specifically interested in primates?
Well, I never even saw a primate other than humans until I was in the third grade and went to the Buffalo Zoo. And that was my first inspiration. I saw a capuchin monkey and I'll never forget it. But I never thought that I would ever be studying them because, of course, that just wasn't an option in those days. I was a biology major in college and was particularly interested in ecology. But when I got out of the university, I wasn't ready for graduate school yet. And so I got a job that wasn't in biology, but rather social work in New York. And so I put aside my love for mammals for several years as I worked with humans in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And I fell in love. I fell in love with a primate in a pet store. Now I know that nowadays to purchase a monkey in a pet store is a really big no-no. But I didn't know that then. It was a long time ago in the 60s. And this incredible little monkey called the owl monkey or the night monkey was from South America. And I brought it home and my husband and I began to understand the amazing habits of this animal and decided that we should go to South America and figure out what it did in the wild. So that's the first time I ever went to the rainforest. The jungles was in southern Colombia. And it was an amazing thing. It was love at first sight. I love rainforest. I love all the animals in them. And I just fell in love with the monkeys that were there in the Amazon. And I ended up, of course, getting a PhD studying that monkey, the one that I bought in the pet store. Nobody else had studied it at all in the wild. It was nocturnal. And you know what else is nocturnal? Jaguars, Fairlands, Bushmasters. Nobody would go out with me. I was very, very far in the jungle in Peru, in a place called Cochacachu. And this was in Manu National Park in Peru. But I spent a year in the rainforest at the Cochacachu Research Station and came out with the first information about that incredible monkey. And then from there, I made it to Madagascar.
And how did that happen? What was it about Madagascar specifically that drew your attention?
Well, I hadn't learned very much about lemurs in graduate school. I didn't know anything about Madagascar. But one day, Dr. Elwin Simons from the Duke Primate Center called me up and said that he thought that I was the person to help him study tarsiers in Asia. And I wasn't quite through with my PhD dissertation yet, but my advisor said Duke University is a good place to go. So I journeyed all the way to North Carolina. And within 3 months, I was in Borneo looking for the tarsier, which I found and brought back 12 to the Duke Primate Center. And then Dr. Simon said, that's one species. Let's try another one. Sent me off to the Philippines, and I brought back another 12. So I started out working at Duke with tarsiers, which are those little tiny primates with the big eyes and the only primate that eats nothing but live animal prey. Luckily, it's a tiny primate, so we don't have to be afraid of it. But it was hard to keep it in captivity, and we had the only collection for a very long time. And then Dr. Simon said, what about Madagascar? What do you think about going to Madagascar and studying lemurs? And he had a special project in mind. He thought that it would be nice to find out whether the greater bamboo lemur, Haplemur simus, was indeed alive or extinct. And nobody had seen it for, you know, decades in the wild in Madagascar. So he asked me if I would be interested in going over there to search for the greater bamboo lemur. And I said, sure. And then a few months later, I was there in Madagascar. I had no idea how poor Madagascar was at the time when I left. I mean, there were hardly any cars at that time. It was at the end of a very difficult time for Madagascar. And we had to bring a vehicle actually from Egypt, where Dr. Simons had a paleontological expedition. And I started out by looking at all the places where the greater bamboo lemur had been seen alive previously. Very disappointed. The roads were terrible. We were stuck all the time. It seemed like there was flat tire after flat tire. It was me and a couple of my graduate students and a research assistant that I had in the Amazon. And we just couldn't find the Haplemur simus anywhere. And then we came to Ranmafon. And the reason why we stopped in Ranmafon is we've been camping out in the rainforest and along the side of the road or in villages for over a month. And most of the time we had cold water or cold streams that we were bathing in. And Ranmafon means hot water. And the Hotel Thermal meant the hotel was hot water. So that's why we stopped in Ranmafon originally, just to get a hot bath. After we got our hot bath, I looked out in the back of the hotel and there was beautiful rainforest. So I asked if we could possibly get into that rainforest, and the hotel owner called two local people, Emil and Lorraine, and they were our first local guides. They guided us into that rainforest, but we had to go over a very treacherous bridge made of only a few trunks to trees, where it was slats of boards over. It was quite it was something I really didn't want to go over that bridge, but I'm glad I did, because when I made it to the other side, it was a gorgeous rainforest, as good as anything I'd seen in the Amazon. And we started looking for lemurs. We camped out, and it took about 3 days before we saw a lemur at all, because they had been hunted and they were running away. And then one morning, about a month into our trip, I got up early and I went walking along in the mist. You know, this is a fairly high for Madagascar. We were in, and it was a misty, cold morning. And suddenly I heard something that I had never heard before. I looked to the right, and there, very close, was a beautiful, must have been a lemur, I thought. It was a golden orange color, and it was staring right at me, and it twirled its tail around like a windmill. I'd never seen any animal do that before. And then it started to growl, and it sounded like almost like a motor starting, and it growled and growled. It was really quite threatening, and it stared at me, and then suddenly it jumped away. And I said to my graduate student that was behind me, I said, did you see it? And she said, no, but I heard it. I said, it must have been the greater bamboo lemur, because it's in the bamboo, but it's a different color. And I had no idea that it was not the greater bamboo lemur at all, but it was a new species to science. And we figured that out because a couple of weeks later, we found the greater bamboo lemur in that same forest. It was much bigger, and it was gray, and it had white ear tufts. And so it was at that moment that I realized that I'd had previously seen something nobody else had really described before. It was an exciting moment to see a new species of primate. And we got that described. How do you describe a new species? Well, we captured the three closest relatives and just compared them both genetically and morphologically, and they're definitely different. The small bamboo lemur weighs about a kilo and is gray and monogamous. The golden bamboo lemur, which is a new species to science, weighs about 2 kilos and is orange and absolutely and monogamous also. And then the greater bamboo lemur, which we finally found, the one that we thought was extinct, is not extinct. It weighs almost 3 kilos and has white ear tufts and is gray and eats the trunks of bamboo. All three of these species are specialists on bamboo, which is kind of amazing for a primate anyway. We've all heard of panda bears eating bamboo, but not many people know about these primate pandas, extraordinary animals from Madagascar.
Wow, that sounds like one heck of a field trip. How exciting to discover a new species and then rediscover a lost one. I'm very interested, but I'm sort of struck by you saying that when you went to Ranomer Farm back then, it took you 3 days to see a lemur, because now you see them within half an hour often of entering the park. Well, I have. So clearly the national park status has changed things a lot. And you were instrumental in setting up the park, I believe. Can you talk about that process? How long did it take? And who did you have to persuade?
Well, shortly after we discovered these new species and the other species, the rediscovered and the new species to science, timber exploiters came in and started chopping down the trees. I got pretty upset, and I went to Tananarive and talked to the director of Water and Forest. And I said, you have to stop these people from cutting down the forest, because we have this new species to science and one rediscovered. And he stopped and he looked at me and he said, yes, Madam Patricia, I understand that these are new species and this is important. But this is Madagascar. We have no money to establish a national park. You have to do the mapping, you have to do the infrastructure, you have to train the people and hire the people. There's no way that Madagascar has that kind of money. And then he stopped and he turned to me and he said, but if you can find the money, Ana Patricia, we will help you to establish a national park. And then he let me out of his office, ushered me out of his office. And I stood there and I kept saying no to myself. No, I just, you know, I've been trained as a primatologist. I don't know how to make a national park. I don't know how to make millions of dollars. And then I thought to myself, but I couldn't live with myself if those species of lemurs went extinct because they weren't protected. So we decided we were going to help the national park to be established. And the way we did it was I wrote a grant to USAID. And I wrote that grant after I had visited all the villages around the park. So we really talked to all the different people in the, around the park, the elders in each of the villages around the park, to ask them what would make it up to them to have that forest that's in back of them a protected area. They wouldn't be able to hunt anymore. They wouldn't be able to get construction wood. And they said there are three things. They wanted schools because they wanted their kids to be able to do something more than slash and burn agriculture. And if you can't read and write, you know, you don't have any choices. They wanted health care because they had to walk 1 or 2 days to reach a clinic. And even though they had traditional medicine, they realized that other people had medicine that worked for some things better than their traditional medicine. They asked for help with the rice paddies. Madagascar is a rice-based culture, and rice is their lives, and that's the main food that they eat. And they asked for a soccer ball because they had nothing to play soccer with except the rags that were made into a ball-like form. So I had an idea of what they wanted. So when I wrote that USAID grant, you know, I asked for all those things. But USAID did award me a grant pretty close to $4 million in 1990. I think it was August 20th, 1990. That was 3 years after I wrote the grant. And in that grant, they had said nothing about healthcare. They said they weren't going to fund that. They said nothing about education. So I had to go outside to get those components to what the villagers wanted. And I actually went to Liz Claiborne, and Liz Claiborne gave me about $500,000 to help with the house. And I went to the MacArthur Foundation, helped with some of the education. And I learned early on that donors have just specific things that they can fund, and that to really do good conservation, you have to have more than those specific things, and you have to find a jigsaw puzzle full of funders to really make conservation work. Because I really believe now, and did then, that if you don't really do an integrated approach to conservation, working with the communities from the very beginning, it doesn't work. So we've been doing that ever since. It's been a long time now. Mm-hmm. It was in 1991 that we established this national park, Ranomafon National Park, and it became a World Heritage Site in 2007.
And obviously, that's fairly unusual for a national park on the African continent to have been established with the full support of local communities. That's both incredible and marvelous. I'm assuming that they have been involved in the park since then. What sort of community work do you still do in the area?
Okay, well, we have involved with our research station. We have an education team, 10 people that are working in, I think, 75. We have 75 villages that we work in. I think there's 35 that are working with our education team, about another 30 that are working with our health team. We have a remote health team that goes out to those villages. And this education team also goes to schools all around the park. And then we do a lot of reforestation. We hire local people to grow endemic species of trees and then put special high value crops like vanilla. You've heard of Malagasy vanilla, and like wild pepper too. That's something that's really special for our region. And so that the people have the crops that they can use, but it's inside the forest. So eventually the lemurs will be able to return to those same forests and eat the fruits of the endemic trees. So it works, it's a win-win situation. Wildlife enjoys this new forest and can expand out of the park into this new forest, and people can harvest these eco crops. And we've been working with these villages now for 30 years, so we have a lot of trust built up. And it's also tourism, of course, has been a big boon. When we started, there were no tourists to the national park. And now I think in 2019, before COVID, we had over 45,000. And this year, I think we're going to get up near that because things have rebounded since the COVID issue. I mean, COVID just literally stopped all travel. And that meant no tourists, no researchers. And that was it was devastating. And we worked very closely with our conservation organizations to try to fund the tourist guides and the research guides, even though there was nobody there. We had to raise special funds. The Leakey Foundation helped, Rewild helped. It was wonderful that we could raise that money and get through that tough time.
Indeed. And some of those tourists, not 40,000, but a few of them, are primate watchers.
Yes.
And so as you mentioned Rewild and Russ Mittermeier earlier before we started recording, and Russ has been one of the people who's championing the idea of primate watching, which is going around the world with trying to see listing primates, particularly in Madagascar. What do you think of the idea? What do you think of the opportunities and the possible risks with this?
First of all, I think it's a great idea. You know, there's been bird watching, of course, has been very, very successful all over the world. People go around and try to tick off as many birds as they can possibly see, the species. And that works very well for Madagascar because, of course, we have birds that can be found nowhere else on Earth. But we also have primates that can be found nowhere else on Earth. And it requires going all over Madagascar to see all the different species, but I think it's a wonderful endeavor. So I'm very much in favor of primate watching. I think Russ Mittermeier has started a wonderful trend. And of course, he's the leader. He's seen more primates than anybody else, and that's great fun. But there are others who are following in his footsteps. So I'm really pleased about that. And he's got checklists for primates, and so everybody can follow through on trying to get as many seen as possible, many species seen. We have 15 species now at Ranmafon National Park. Mm-hmm. And so in a couple days, you can see almost all of them. Mm-hmm. But as you said, in a couple hours, you can see, you know, four to eight species. So Ranmafon is a good place to do your primate watching in Madagascar. But I think it's a great idea. And are there downsides to primate watching? Well, I suppose a little bit. You know, it's if you don't have managed tourism, that's a problem. So I think it's just a matter of being sure that tourism is managed.
Yep.
Yeah. Agreed. That's always the issue, isn't it? But I was just thinking of that figure of 15 primate species. That must make Ranomafana one of the most diverse places on the planet for primates. I'm struggling to think of any other area of that size which would have that diversity.
It's really amazing. In Congo, Of course, there are, because in Africa, you have apes, monkeys, and prosimian primates.
Mm-hmm.
So there are few sites in Africa. But for Madagascar, I mean, it's an amazing place that you can see so many.
Yeah.
They're all, you know, they're all prosimian primates. We have no great apes. We have no monkeys. So they're all one group, which is astounding.
Right. And we've, you've talked about so ecotourism and primate watchers. Do you see much scope for more areas being protected through ecotourism? And are there any other areas that are particularly important for lemurs that you feel are in urgent need of protection?
First of all, yes. I do find a lot of places that are in urgent need of protection. We've done an amazing job over these last 20, 30 years of establishing protected areas. You know, there's like 18 national parks, and there's many community protected national parks now too, which is a whole new concept, which is wonderful. It's working very well. And that's when the revenue comes back to the communities themselves. And they're basically, their number one source of income are primates. And that, I think that works very well. But there are many areas in Madagascar that still need protection. Rainforest Trust is an organization that has just recently come to Madagascar, that their primary theme is to protect new areas. So when we discovered a new area just recently in 2016, we turned to Rainforest Trust to help us to fund it, and they did. And so between 2016 and 2023, it is now a protected area and working with the villagers. So that was great. But there's other places also that we should be investigating and protecting as quickly as possible. You know, Madagascar, the whole island is on the brink of extinction. And it's a place where, you know, we have some animals that only have like 17 or 37 individuals left. In Ranomafon, that golden bamboo lemur that I discovered, I mean, there was 1,000 of them living, you know, at all, you know, 1,000 left. Now, with the protection of Ranomafon National Park, we've increased that to double. Yeah. So protected areas really do make a big difference. They stop the hunting and they make it possible for animals to expand. But I think we have to realize that we have to protect everything we can in Madagascar. I mean, there's not much time left. And there's fires that rage through that island every year. And we have to work with preventing those fires. And there's many things that are yet to do in Madagascar. Our work has just started.
Hmm. Patricia, what was the name of the new protected area that you set up with the Rainforest Trust?
Yes, this is Evuiburu. It's a place that we call the lost rainforest of Crystal Mountain. When we first found it, it was a total surprise because it's almost in the center of Madagascar, where nearly all, you know, 90% of the forests in Madagascar are gone. So to find almost 2,000 hectares of real rainforest, like Ranomafon, it was such a surprise for us. And we immediately started to try to find as many species there as possible. And so we have. And I just got back from a big expedition. We had 50 scientists that were gathered together to go to the lost rainforest to try to find as many new species as possible. It's not easy because the roads are just dreadful. And so it takes a long time to get there from anywhere. And then once the roads, that you're at the end of the road, then you have to climb up the mountain for, well, it depends upon which part of this new protected area you go to. We've just, with Rainforest Trust funding, established a headquarters, and that's the best place to head up to see that amazing forest. And that's only an hour walk. But we also went to the southern part of that rainforest, and that took us 5 hours to get up Crystal Mountain. It's a long trek. We had 50 scientists, but that means a lot more people for backup and for local guides too. So, and porters, we had 300 porters. Then we traveled up that mountain. It looked like a expedition from the 1800s as we brought all everything that we needed, rice and tents and everything up that mountain. It was quite something, but it was great fun. And we learned, we got many new species. We found, I think, a new species of mouse lemur, a new species of dwarf lemur. And another big surprise was the ring-tailed lemur, which is found in the very arid part of Madagascar in the desert, the thorny scrub desert of Madagascar. We found it inside the rainforest.
Wow.
And it was like, I'm a behavioral ecologist, and I really wanted to know what it was doing differently in the rainforest than in the spiny desert. Because in the spiny desert, I think you've all heard of the stink fights that the ring-tailed lemur does. They anoint their tails with a special scent, and then they use it like a flag where they wave their tails in the air to frighten off the other groups. And it's just, you can't do that in the rainforest. You can't see. So how do they function with all the behaviors that they've evolved to use in the dry forest? How does that work in the rainforest? And so that was one of our questions. And one of the things we found out, one of our researchers, Gabby Bueno, found out that it makes a difference in infant development. I mean, the infants in the dry forest grow up much faster. The infants in the rainforest, they just cling on to their parents and to their mothers for 2 or 3 weeks longer. Because if you fall in the rainforest, you're falling, 50 feet, and that can create injuries. But when you're in the dry forest, there's, you're only about a couple meters high. So anyway, we found that there is a great difference in some of the behaviors that these lemurs do in the rainforest they wouldn't do in the dry forest. So that's been fun. We've also seen, we have all the predators in this lost rainforest. We have boa constrictors, we have the hawks and eagles, and we have the fusa. So this is a rainforest that has all the predators and an amazing selection of birds, chameleons, mammals. It's really an amazing place. And we didn't know anything about it. Scientists had never seen it. And even the local people had been very afraid of the forest and had not gone into it. So it's been exciting.
Wow. And is that area accessible to tourism at the moment or not yet?
All right. We're preparing it, So, we've already, we have that headquarters where tourists could, start from to climb up the mountain. And on the top of the mountain, we actually have tent sites that are, it's quite high up there. And it's like a wind tunnel. And there's lots of wind. It's very misty. The rains are generated by the forest. So it's cold and windy and rainy and misty. Quite different from the lowlands where you don't have any forest left. So it will eventually be, a place that tourists can visit. Right now, it would be only extreme tourism. And until they fix the roads It's not going to be easily accessible, but it's a beautiful place, and people perhaps will be able to in a few years visit.
Wow. Well, I'm going back to Madagascar in 2025, I hope. So I would love to visit this place. It sounds amazing. Wow.
Oh, okay. We'll arrange for you to come.
Oh, that's I wasn't fishing for that, but thank you. Yeah, just to see winged-tailed lemurs in the rainforest, that's remarkable. So one of the things I've noticed, and I think other people have too, when they mammal watchers when we visit Madagascar, is the quality of the local guides. Guides in other countries are often quite good at finding a few things, but in Madagascar, there, just about all the local guides I've met know where not just to find the sort of bigger animals like the bigger lemurs, they know the rodents, the bats. It's quite remarkable. You can turn up in a place and just tick your list to your heart's content for 48 hours and see so much. Do you know how that happened? Where do these skills come from?
Well, I think I know where it happened. It started with research. Right. You know, it was amazing because when we first arrived in Madagascar, people knew the local names for things, but they didn't know necessarily an awful lot about the science behind these animals. And when we started out, we started working with the local people. And as different scientists came, they worked with the local people and taught them all about what they knew. And then the local people stayed there and learned more. And it was an exchange, a really great exchange between research scientists and local knowledge. And I think more than any other place, we have been training the local people in all the places where we've been doing research. But I don't know how to say this, but some of the researchers are, you know, research guides and the tourist guides are getting a little bit older. Mm-hmm. So I realized that this could be a problem in years to come, that we would be needing to train more local guides. And so I've just received a grant from WeWild where we were going to train the next generation. And so our guides are going to become professors, and they're going to create, you know, PowerPoint presentations and in Malagasy to train the younger generation about all the things that they've learned from research scientists and from their own observations, of course. So we're going to invite the tourist guides, we're going to invite the research technicians and the Madagascar National Parks rangers too, to become professors. And we at Center of Albayo, you know, it's a research station. We will we've just got the funding so that we could be starting to train that next generation of guides. So I think this is one of the best projects that we've had in a long time, and I'm really looking forward. It's going to start very soon, so I'm looking forward to training them and to getting, you know, we're going to have sections on birds and sections on mammals and sections on lemurs, but sections on conservation biology too, so that they can learn the principles of conservation biology, but they can also learn the technology. Because, you know, we have so much more technology now with camera traps and, you know, the smart system of monitoring and evaluation and drones, conservation drones. I mean, there's so many. And audio moss, where, you know, you take recordings in the village, in the forest, and then can figure out which animals are there by their calls. Mm-hmm. All of these things, they will learn that too. And then at the end of these classes, we're going to teach them how to apply for a job and how to, you know, we'll also teach them English, because for the tourist guides in particular, they need to know English in addition to French and Malagasy. So it's going to be a well-rounded university of biodiversity that we're going to be presenting them. And hopefully this first year will be such a success that we'll be able to expand our reach away from Ranomafon to all the other protected areas on Carafonseca, Montadi, all the other national parks, so that we will be teaching biodiversity lessons to young people all over the island.
Yeah. I'm grinning from ear to ear as you talk about this. It sounds a brilliant project. And I love the idea of some of those older guides becoming professors. Because absolutely, you talk to them, they know there's nothing they don't seem to know about that forest. That's wonderful to pass the knowledge down. How
It
cool.
is true.
Yeah.
And then after they get the certificate, they're going to have to, we're going to put a lot of effort into getting them jobs. Jobs in the national park, jobs as tourist guides, or jobs in research.
Right.
Wonderful.
Sounds like the sort of program that actually needs to be replicated pretty much all around the world, frankly. But sounds absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, it's so important that local people get funded for their knowledge. I think that's just so prime.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Now, Patricia, I'm guessing that you have seen many, many species of lemurs in Madagascar. Are there any left that you haven't seen that you would particularly like to see?
You know, it's amazing because after all these years, I've seen a lot of lemurs in Madagascar. My checklist is almost complete.
Oh,
but
wow.
There's one species that I haven't seen, and it's called the blue-eyed black lemur. You know, it's these extraordinary on this one peninsula. There's this the black lemur variety that has the brightest blue eyes, and I have not been to that peninsula yet. So that's pretty much the only one. I've seen the eyes. I've seen all the shifakas. I've seen, you know, in the night too. I've seen the different kinds of fanner. Yeah, I've seen lots of different species, but I have not yet checked off my list the blue-eyed black lemur.
There's always one species, isn't there? That...
Yeah. Hopefully, I'll get there sometime soon.
And on the note, you're one of the very first people who has not just rediscovered a new species, but discovered a new species. Do you think that there are still lemur species out there to be discovered on Madagascar?
You know, we research scientists have done a good job of increasing the numbers of species. You know, there were 32 species when I went to graduate school. And now, I mean, Russ is saying there's over 113, 100. Yeah. So I have a feeling that especially in the nocturnal species, there are a number of species. In fact, I'm almost positive that we have a new species of mouse lemur and a new species of dwarf lemur from that lost rainforest expedition. So sure, and there are other unexplored forests in Madagascar still. It's amazing to think about, but it's true that they're very remote forests that you have to walk for days to find. But I think we should concentrate on them and see if we can get some more species. There's never enough, right?
Now,
it's important to discover these new species because that's otherwise they don't get protected. If we know that there's a new species to science, we can make sure that that forest is protected.
So, Patricia, is there anything else that you would like to tell our audience about?
I'd like to talk about partnerships. Because I think one thing that is extraordinary about conservation is that there's no way one person, one group can possibly accomplish real conservation until you make partners with lots of other organizations. We've made good partnership with Catholic Relief Services who do wonderful work in villages and on malnutrition and those aspects. We're working with them on the spices project where we're growing endemic species of trees and then putting the spices into the forest. I think Rainforest Trust, Phoenix Conservancy, there's many organizations that we work with, PIVOT, which is a health organization, because one organization just doesn't have the expertise to cover all the aspects of conservation that you really need. I believe firmly that conservation should be based on science and research, and that the first step is to find out which species are in an area and what those species do and how we can conserve them, and then go from there. So I think partnerships are important. I think basing conservation in science is important. I think we need more people helping. It's critical that we have more students, more young people getting really engaged. I know a lot of young people now feel discouraged that, you know, with climate change and all the other things that are happening in the world, that they feel helpless, and they shouldn't. They should just dig in and help, because there is so much to do and everybody can take a role. Everybody has different skills, and those skills can be used to conserve our wildlife, to conserve our mammals, conserve our lemurs.
Yes, and we also need more mammal watchers and particularly primate watchers to be able to get to these extreme sites to go and to start pumping some income into these areas and help conserve the animals there.
Absolutely. You know, mammal watching is really fun. I love the primates. Into the best, but all the mammals are great.
So, Patricia, thank you so much for the fascinating conversation. And I must admit, Madagascar really is an astonishing country for mammals and for mammal watchers, despite the very obvious threats and the difficult logistics of getting around. But thank you for playing such a big role in ensuring that the country's wildlife is protected.
Thank you for inviting me to talk about it. This has been great.
And thanks for me, Patricia. It's inspiring to listen to you. I hope other people will be too, to, as you say, to dig their heels in and just do something, especially younger people. And I love your expression, a jigsaw puzzle full of wonders. All the different parts of the picture you glued together in that country to help communities and people and agencies and partnerships to protect some of these absolutely precious areas of land that are in such threat. So thank you. It's been a real pleasure listening and talking to you.
Thank you. And I'm looking forward to you coming next year explore the lost rainforest.
You've been listening to Mammal Watching with Charles Foley and John Hall. You can find other episodes at mammalwatching.com/podcast.